Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and I was a bit overwhelmed at the seemingly disconnected news that flooded the headlines on Monday. First, I was just heartbroken when I read that 16-year-old Anesha Bauer was murdered, then thrown in her house, which was set on fire, another baby killed in our city. Then we learned that Kalief Browder took his own life over the weekend. He was the young man who spent 3 years in the infamous Rikers Island prison in New York City, picked up for allegedly never proven, never gone to court for stealing a backpack. He was beaten by police and prison guards and gang members while held in prison. He tried to hold it together when he was freed, but this innocence succumbed to pain in his soul from the torture he received in our prisons. And then I read Albert Woodfox was about to be freed after 40 years of solitary confinement in the infamous maximum security prison in Louisiana known as Angola. He was part of the Angola Three, three men who started a Black Panther chapter in the Angola prison in 1971, fighting for rights of inmates. A riot ensued. A guard was killed. He was accused, though never proven, to have committed this murder and spent 40 years in solitary torture. Now freed, but not, as Louisiana fights to keep him in isolation till he draws his last breath. And community activists in Sandtown, Winchester, create worlds of beauty, creativity, and peace to take their community back, to move their community forward, to take hold of their own lives and the lives of their neighbors, of their children, of their future. These moments are so intertwined. What mass incarceration does to destroy a community already destroyed by deindustrialization and racism is at the heart of this interconnection. What do we do? We are joined today to wrestle with that. J.C. Falk, a community organizer and community development consultant in Sandtown, Winchester, was behind many murals that are now going up in that community. Mia Loving will be joining us soon, curator and founder of Invisible Majority, a creative community incubator. Delegate Jill Carter is with us. Maryland State Delegate representing the 41st District in Baltimore City, who's been a voice in the House of Delegates for many of these communities. And Michael Scott, Chief Equity Officer and President and Co-Founder of Equity Matters. You can join us here at 410-319-8888. You can log on to our Facebook pages, write to us at talk@steinershow.org. But please do join us, 410-319-8888. So what do we do? I mean, Delegate Carter, glad you're with us. Let me start with you. I mean, am I crazy or are all these things connected?
Well, all these things are connected, and listening to your recitation of history on this day, I couldn't help but thinking, how far have we really come? Not very far, because those very issues that Marcus Garvey was fighting for example, exist today. And what we do, I think, is it's easier said than done, but, you know, the dialogue is important, but the action is more important. Much of this is directly connected or indirectly connected to the political power structure and our inability or refusal to accept that we should exert control over our own political power structure. We continue to act as if we must fight against persons that we elect to represent us. And I think that all of these things are directly related. For example, it's lovely that there are efforts now to revitalize Sandtown, Winchester, and the aesthetic work that's going on. But the bottom line is that the community, this community and other communities, the victims of benign neglect by the political power structure for a very long time, it should not be incumbent upon the persons that are suffering to enact the revitalization. It should be a demand of the political power structure to change the way that they have treated these communities. Mass incarceration is a critical issue, but it's the result of a number of things that need to be addressed and prevented, such as denial of opportunity, such as in Baltimore we continue to lead poison children, which always leads to death or destruction and a complete lack of an inability to exist in society in a productive way. So these are all the things that politics is in control of, but we fail to demand better from politicians and our political power structure, and that's what we must do.
J.C., it's your community. You live in Sandtown.
I actually live in Station North.
Station North.
Yes.
You've been working deeply in Sandtown.
Yes, I have.
So let me get you closer to the mic so we can hear your voice.
No problem.
There we go.
Okay.
That's it. So, I mean, talk a bit about how you see these connections and what your work has done.
Yes, I see them very strongly. In the when the CVS burned, as the CVS was burning, I was at the Safeway when the CVS was burning. I went towards the fire as people were leaving out. And I was there after curfew multiple nights and watched what the police did with people in Sandtown after curfew. It was horrendous how they were treating people there, and especially when we had competing video images in Hamden where they were treating people very kindly. And so in the community, it was very it's been amazing for me. I took a friend up the other day who owns a yoga studio, and she said that she leaves this country sometimes to have the experience that she had when she was there of people being very kind and purely people who have nothing, who are impoverished, but you get these real clean, pure, beautiful spirits from them. And she didn't expect it when she got there. She was a little bit, you know, a little bit nervous about going up, I think. But when you get there and you see the people, it is it's despicable that in an American city we have people living in the way that people are living in Sandtown. And it's not – I'm not saying it's them. I'm saying how is it that we have so many people in an impoverished area like that that's been burned out since the 60s and someone hasn't come in to do something to change it up? So what we're trying to do is to beautify the areas that we can. We've been in there right now, Mark, with no funding, nothing. There's just – we're just on the ground doing what we can do. So we put up a mural. Wherever there's land around that mural that can be beautified, we beautify it. We figure it out, you know, make a way out of no way. I've gone over to Home Depot and different places and said, hey, we need stuff, and they give it to us. And we've beautified a couple of lots there, and we've gotten four murals up right now. We got three up, and we have a fourth one that we're working on. We've had no funding yet. So if we can do that with nothing, I wonder what's happened with all of the funding that we've had up to this point that was supposed to go in there and clean this place up. Just a second, we were talking about the lead poisoning. There are multiple schools in Sandtown where the kids can't drink the water out of the fountains. They have to ship in water, bottled water, so that our children, American children, have to drink water out of bottles rather than drinking them out of fountains in the school. Something's very wrong with that. So we're trying to raise it up, put murals up and raise it up and have people to understand that we have people who are going through really horrible stuff and we can do something about it.
I mean, it's good to see you again. I read your piece this morning, by the way, which was
awesome.
Really interesting. Did a lot of research for that piece.
Mm-hmm. That was on youth violence and incarceration when I was working as the Youth Empowerment Through Conflict Resolution Director at AFSC. And I was just really trying to make the connections between community violence and kind of state violence and the solutions that we tend to use, which are generally incarceration and heavy arrest and high police presence, and just kind of showing that these things generally don't work and they don't make any of us feel any safer, or at least those of us on the ground. And it doesn't, you know, it doesn't put our children in positions to have healthier and more productive lives, you know. And so one thing I think has been fortunate about everything that's been happening in the past couple months are people kind of stepping up in the communities, trying to take back control of their communities and things. I pretty much grew up, you know, in the Sandtown area, more or less. And you know, I remember when we were kind of in the streets and dancing and playing games and all of these things that you hadn't really seen until recently, or even the murals that used to be up and they just kind of decayed. And, you know, that's one of the reasons why I've been speaking out against certain arts things, you know, to see stuff go up this place and then things go down in other places compared to how I grew up. But the unfortunate thing that I've seen, and I think Delegate Carter kind of spoke to it, is the kind of repositioning of blame to the actual people who are suffering and putting all responsibility. And now everything has become about what these youth did, and we need to go and, and save them so they're not burning down CVS's anymore. And we're no longer looking at the issue of economic violence and the fact that the policing systems that we're putting in place do not work. And using more proactive programs, and I use that term loosely when it comes to reducing youth violence in the city.
So, Michael Scott, let me kind of throw this conversation to you for a moment, and then also get folks to join us here, 410-319-8888. This is another one of our solutions hours, which we're going to wrestle with what we can do to change things. I was listening to Morning Edition on a station in Washington, and one of the stories was about Glasgow, Scotland, which is a mostly white city, and it's known as the most violent city in Europe, where they had like 48 murders per 1 million or 100,000, whatever that number was that they quoted. And then they've gotten down to less than 15. And how did they do that? And they talked about how they began to build programs in that community that offered jobs, that built a community center, that fixed up housing, that depoliced the community and let the community figure out ways of policing itself, and began to ameliorate the violence in the middle of Glasgow, Scotland. It was a really interesting piece that I heard. And then we had this the other week we had on here, we've done before, the folks from Safe Streets. And during the last month, when violence has gripped the city internally in the community, where over 40 people were murdered, the four posts that were high murder areas at one point in the city, there were four posts that were run by Safe Streets, by men and women, for the most part, who had done time and come out to really change their communities, not one murder and only one shooting in the neighborhoods where they were there, where they could walk up to people. So, and we think about what's going on in Sandtown, others, to creatively trying to take back community. So what does this say to us about what we need to start pushing for, Michael Scott? We got it. I mean, there has to be a fight for a change in terms of policy and the way things are done, because we can't keep doing this over and over again. The police are not going to solve this problem. We have to save our children and our communities.
Yeah, so I thought you were going to say they confiscated all the broadswords in Scotland.
It was they used more knives than guns in the killings in Glasgow. The guns don't proliferate in England like they do here.
Yeah, no, I just needed a moment of humor to kind of I think the thing that ties all this together is that the dehumanization of folks, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you talked about racism and how that happens, and whether you're talking about the data around how black and brown children are seen as 4 years older than they are, whether we're incarcerating them at earlier ages, whether you're dehumanizing people in incarcerated places, like the Angola 3. I had a chance to meet in his home Charles King and have a and
he was one of the Angola 3.
He was one of the Angola 3 to have,
right.
Have a drink and break some bread with him. And I was struck by how sane and human he was. And he said, I'm really not. but I mean, he's functioning. And he said, they used me to justify continued torture in the form of solitary confinement. And so that's another example of how we dehumanize people. And what the delegate said is really true. I think we need to take a head, heart, and hands approach to how we rehumanize folks. And so certainly the policy pieces have to go forth. We have to look at the systemic impacts because, as my sister just said, this is not, Mike Hancher just did a piece too internationally comparing state violence, police brutality, and health, right? This is happening internationally, so there's something systemic, and we need to be smart about our policy approaches. But, I mean, there's and then we have to get to work, as we've seen, the brother painting the murals and, all the great activism that's gone on in the past few weeks. But then there's a heart space, too, right, like where we have to really – and that's the slow, steady work because you can't mandate a law to change people's hearts and minds, But that's the really – the perspective transformation to begin to rehumanize these people who we think are, as a society, think are disposable or throwaway or not as human as some of us, right? And I think that can't be lost in wherever we enter this debate, whether we're policy wonks and want to do that piece, whether we're hands on the ground and want to get our hands dirty and do that piece. We have to also keep in mind that what's tying all this together, the brother committing suicide, was his dehumanization.
So I think that one of the things most of us know in this panel, many of people listening to this program at 410-319-8888 know is the history that ties us together, aware of the kind of racism and the industrialization that created the world we're in. The question I have is, where do we go? And it's not going to happen overnight. It's going to be a fight and a slog to get things done, but it has to begin. So what are the things that have to be done politically and socially on a broader sense, but also from our communities inside out to begin to change what is happening? This is what I think we have to begin to think about, and almost in spite of our political leadership, build something brand new that they're not even thinking about.
So can I just say, the philosophical piece is one, but you have to provide a particular alternative reality on the other. And I think when we start talking about community wealth building, when we start talking about how people can show up differently. We talk about dismantling the prison industrial complex. We've never talked about what the alternative looks like. And you're not going to advocate yourself out of a job, whether you're a public defender trying to do the right thing or a probation officer, right? Like, where are they going to go? And unless we have that conversation, the people are not going to dismantle all the things that lead to this dehumanization.
The other conversation has to happen first. I mean, I hear what you're saying. But, Joe Carter, before we go to break here, I'm going to get...
Yeah, I think part of it is we need to recognize who needs to be rehumanized. It's not the people in Sandtown. It's the police who go in there and kill people indiscriminately. They're the ones who need to be rehumanized. There's something very animalistic and violent about what they do. So that's one piece of it. But essentially on the ground, I think what we need to recognize is that we're kind of a symptom-driven culture. So if something happens, we go after, we put a bandage on it, or we try to address that thing. We need to get on the ground and stay on the ground and address things like racism. We know we have two parts of the city pretty much that are very impoverished. We have Pigtown, we have Sandtown. Right. So if those two areas I want to talk about for a second. In Sandtown, the poverty there is no different. The poverty in Sandtown and Pigtown, that's no real difference. There's people who are poor in those areas. But you overlay race on it, and then people start to die over in Sandtown. You know, the police go in and they start killing people. So until we get down and we start really dealing with the racism piece that's underneath of it, it's not going to go away. We're going to still have it there.
But Jill, let me ask you before we take us to break here with some thoughts about, I mean, you've been a political leader for a long time. How long have you been in the House of Delegates now? 20 years? Just 20, okay. I wasn't sure. It feels like a while, but I know you've been there a long time and you've been on the guest on the show with that. And I think about what it is what our political leaders, like as you are, have to begin to proffer to the public about what ideas we have to change the way we're doing things. Instead of incarceration, what do? To make our community safe and to help people.
Mark, first of all, I'm different. I always call myself a people's representative, not a political leader, and I think the evidence is there that I'm not. Because when it comes to legislature, I am not a leader in the legislative leadership. I'm not, you know, speaker or chair of a committee, except for UNLA, a subcommittee. But the point is that I don't agree exactly that we need to separate the issues and say, well, what do people on the ground do, and that aside from politics, what people on the ground must do is connect the dots and connect the grassroots movements between who politics change, political change.
Delegate, I'm going to have to interrupt just because something's wrong with our phone connection. We're not hearing you very well. And I can hear from what you're saying. You're saying some really important things. We're going to take a break. They're going to call back Delegate Carter so we can get her right back on the line and then come back to our other guests. We'll be right back. Alan Wolfe, Down in the Bottom. He was born today in 1910, and we went to break with Mama Said by the great Shirelles. Shirley Owens of the Shirelles passed away, was born on this day in 1941, and on this day, Addie Harris of the Shirelles passed away in 1982. So we honor that great singing group. 410-319-8888. And do we have Delegate back? Oh, you're there. So let me go to Jill. You can say what you were saying, and we're going to go right to Mia, and then to the phones.
Thanks, Mark. I hope that you can hear me.
We got you now.
Okay. Well, what I was saying is that too often I get very frustrated when I hear that there's somehow...
We lost you again, Delegate.
...rely on politics. Politics created our situation. And briefly, as a prime example, 12 years ago, I recall sponsoring legislation to get the lead out of the water in the schools.
I remember them.
But legislation passed one house, but not the Senate. But what is significant is That legislation was largely resisted by the then...
The then what? Say that one. I'm sorry, we lost you again. Resisted by who? Shoot.
I know, I need to know
there,
that.
And the people making sure they take control of the people that represent them and not look at it as if some group of people that live in the sky that we have to fight against and that we have to persuade. We rarely make serious demands of people that are running for office. And once they're there, we're happy if they come out to a community barbecue or a meeting. We do not connect the dots in terms of what policy work they do in Annapolis or in the with the political power structure because of the neglect, because of lack of dollars, lack of input into
right.
those communities. The police department is where it is. The police department gets all of the resources, yet we blame the people in the communities for why we're having so many murders and so much crime. We need to accountability to the people in power change it. Then we'll see the trickle-down effect that people on the ground and people in communities will have.
Again, I'm terribly sorry. We keep losing every other word that you're saying, and you're saying some very powerful, important stuff. We're going to try to call back again so we can get a better connection. But and I want to hear who opposed the legislation and lead paint and lead in the water, and we didn't hear who that was. We want to know who that is.
I was in high school when they first brought the bottled waters in.
You
and
were.
If it wasn't for a rumor in the school that the water fountains were toilet water, then I might have been a lot more affected by the school system. But I remember being extremely appalled that, you know, it was lead in our water all this time when we grew up in that, and anybody older than us really grew up on that, and no one seemed to do anything about it. And I think that's one of the many messages or the many things young people see that make them feel devalued or dehumanized, and, you know, going back to that discussion. But going back to the question about solutions, when I was working in several different schools, in West Baltimore especially, and my job was to reduce suspensions and to reduce student incarceration. Because it got into a point where a student could yell at the teacher, and especially if they had a history of that, they would get taken away by police, you know, like very small infractions. And so it was so simple and easy, you know, such an easy job, because all I did was implement mediation and teach conflict resolution skills. And so having students understand that they can actually talk through a problem, that they can listen, you know, from other people's perspectives. And I did that without judging them. You know, I didn't tell them that violence was always wrong. And I can't tell people who are surrounded by violence and see people get thrown on the street and handcuffed, or see, you know, family member, whatever issues that's surrounded by that, or watching TV and seeing wars, and be able to seriously look in their face and say, violence is bad. Like, of course I said, but I would ask them more and more questions. You know, is someone, you know, what makes you want to do something violent? Oh, if I feel disrespected. What makes you feel disrespected? Somebody look at me funny. Is somebody looking at you funny worth punching them in their face? You know what? Maybe not. It's just, you know, and that worked really well, you know, just that care. So if we did that on a larger level, if we had more community conferences, mediation, restorative justice practices, where people had to actually look at their infraction, and this is focusing on people actually doing some type of infraction. It's so many people in jail or in prison that didn't do anything, or, you know, laws in place or things that are illegal that aren't worth being illegal. But looking at things our community actually has an issue with, be it violence or whatever, and they take the time to be responsible for that and then do something about it themselves. You know.
See, and this is the part that I think is important, because I think one of the things that has to happen, there's so many levels to this. And clearly we have to talk about how we've talked a bit off mic about this. We talked about on the air before about how to reinvigorate work and jobs for adults to get work. And we all know kids want to, we need adults to have jobs to be able to take care of families and children and build their lives and get houses and homes. And that's one level of it we can get to maybe later. But one of the things you're talking about right now, Mia, is what we can do immediately to intervene in the lives of young people to ameliorate the violence and help young people find themselves so they're not stuck in the rut they're in.
And that's,
right?
And,
I mean, that's to me, I'm sorry.
And this job creation as well. I think the community mediation, I think that's over there in Greenmount, like they hire teenagers to help with these mediations, you know. And it's, I'm not only, you, like you said, an adults getting jobs. This is another industry. So, you know, as the brother here alluded to, like, I'm not going to give up my job as a CEO or all that type of stuff. But if I had a restorative justice practice or something, I would give up my job as a CEO to be a mediator. It's a lot more peaceful. It's a lot less stressful. You know, it's a lot better position. So I would do that, you know.
And I think we those are things we can do. I think that, and almost with a simple stroke of a pen. But we don't.
Yeah, it's about political will, and I think the delegate is right there. And I mean, we know a lot of stuff that works, right? Like you know, we could be here for the entire hour just listing programs that at one point or another that we know made impact, right? Not only elsewhere, but here in this city. But we don't value people the same. So we don't – and our budgets reflect our values. And so we don't invest in them the same, and then we get what we get. And so I think if the delegate maybe was the connection, I don't think any of us were saying that, you know, we need to be siloed. I think we're saying that we need all hands, an integrated approach, hands, heart, and minds to attack this stuff. But, I mean, I think we have to be more active as citizens, demanding more power, to redirecting resources, right? Because it's not about not having there's no paucity of ideas or leadership. It's how those pieces fit together that's the problem.
So let me get – a lot of people calling in. I want to get back to J.C. Let me read this email and get to the phones and on our way to J.C. here. We have an email in from Linda who said, most of the colleges and high schools in the area have community service requirements. I'm sure they would be able to help. Art students at institutions such as Mike and CCBC, as well as landscape architecture students at Morgan, could incorporate Sandtown into their projects as well. I have no doubt that – all would be willing to work with local residents. This would also provide young people with an opportunity to help transform their communities and create a new reality your guests are talking about. Poverty of spirit is worse than poverty itself. Mm-hmm. Quote, she says, only after the last tree has been cut down, only after the last river has been poisoned, only after the last fish has been caught, only then will you find the money that money cannot be eaten, an old Cree Indian proverb. So I mean, I think that again, we don't use those resources. People, we can imagine what would happen if you took the MICA architecture and MICA and Morgan architecture and students and put them into Sandtown, mm-hmm. and had the city say, "Give up. Here's all these houses. Here's these empty lots. Work with the community. Figure out how to recreate community."
Yes, I agree with that, but we also have to have, if you want to be supportive of Sandtown, go to Sandtown. You know, like get to where the people are. It's unlikely that the people in Sandtown are going to, or many of the people who really need the support and the resources are going to be coming to find MICA or coming to find other organizations. There are people there who are on the ground. If MICA reaches out and says they want to have people there, or churches or other organizations reach out, there are people there who are willing to have them there. We're doing projects up there right now. It would be lovely to have people. I was out in a field a couple of days ago doing work Sunday with a group of five of us, you know, tilling and doing those. It would have been lovely to have 20 people there, but you got to reach to us because we're there. Reach to us because we don't know where you are. Or we don't know that you're even available to do it unless you tell us that you're available to do it.
Well, JC, I trust you, but we got to be careful about that because, you know, Station North Arts brought in Roy Cross, right, and used him as the poster child for redevelopment. Then when he wanted to bring in other black faces and his people, he couldn't do that. And now he's gone, right? And so we, what we do well is we descend on these areas. There is a big industry in the peace business, right? And in the nonprofit business, and we have to be really careful about and I trust JC, but we have to be really careful about who we invest in that are from. I mean, there's a history. There's a Lillian Jones Center. That lady's name is on that building for a reason, not because she was a rich and powerful, you know, a person of color, but because she had impact in that community. There's deep historical community, right? And so to his point, I think we can connect those dots in a way that's meaningful. We have to be careful because we have a habit in the city of large institutional players descending and kind of poverty pimping in a way that does not inure to the benefit of the people that live there, and yet other people make a lot of money.
I agree with you on that, and we have to have whatever happens be driven by the community, the people in the community. So that's, after all is said and done, who comes, agreed. There has to be a choice from the community about whether they want to have those people there or not.
So let me go to the phones here and come back to Mia, 410-319-8888. Delegate Carter sends us a message, a text, because her phone was not working right, which is a shame because she was saying some stuff. But she said, the legislator fighting for lead paint issues was me. Well, we knew that, yes. I fought hard to get the lead out of water. O'Malley opposed it, but the city delegation members were pressured into passing it in the House, and he killed it in the Senate. And from that day to this day, it hasn't been fixed. So that's what she was – that's the missing piece she wanted to hear, Mia. That's all you said. 410-319-8888 is the number here. That tells us a lot. Let's go to James. You've been holding on for most of the show. You're on the air, line one.
Yes, sir. The one thing I'd like to say, sir, I think this is the best program that you've ever had. We all like history. You are the most educated person that I've ever listened to. I only have a seventh grade education. But I also know that in 40 years, I've created lots of jobs. I'm doing it now on the Internet. And you can take any family today, and the poverty is our problem. We got pastors on $65 million to buy planes. We got more bishops than we ever had. We have 265 different religions, right? What you can do today, you can give a family of four $50 and find 50 other people with $50, because everything in America is numbers. There's no racism in business. If I can be the first black to own a taxicab association, and they're still on the street right now, dark brown and cream top with seventh grade education, then all these people with PhDs don't realize that they don't have any control of their life. If you don't have any e-commerce, and you don't have the option to make money when you need money, you're just part of the work woodwork. You understand?
Yep.
Everything in the United States is numbers. If I go to New York and buy $150,000 of drugs, the guy will give me a gun. But if I go there with $25,000, they'll post me in a hotel, kill me, and take my $25,000. You can't open a drugstore with a drug dealer that made the money that knows anything about drugstores or grocery stores. When the Koreans go to school for 25 months just to learn how to operate it, and in 30 right. years they come from having the store to now their own supplier. I don't hate the Koreans because they don't harm blacks. I think in America, if we understood the system completely and how the e-commerce works, we would have our own stores and become competitive instead of victims.
All right, Jen, let me let the panel kind of wrestle what you just said for a minute here before we hit our next caller.
I do want to say, like, because when we think about drugs in Baltimore, that's a big issue. But we're not sitting there and thinking about that the drug industry is one of the few that's hiring. So, again, if we do want to counter that and we do want to counter crime, then we have to create these economic opportunities and not just, like, these jobs, but creating ways or teaching people ways to generate income that they don't have to rely on someone else all the time.
I think your caller is a professor in the People's Institute. He just dropped wisdom and knowledge about game within game. And that, you know, the thing about Baltimoreans is we have an analysis, right? Like, people in this town, they know game when they see it, and they know that the different, you know, layers behind things. And that's what I think he was talking about, that, you know, the fact that, you know, no one's going to throw the Koreans or the Japanese, for that matter, the Kaibatsus or whatever they've named their way that they've taken care of their people. Those are innovations, right? But most people don't know that those things exist and that's it just didn't happen magically. There's something behind that, right? And so what he's talking about is revealing that and how do we share those skills, those tools, those strategies, those approaches so that traditionally marginalized populations can start to get some of the social upward mobility that we've been sort of intentionally left out of historically. And, you know, it's wrestling not only with the current but also the history of that intentionality or lack thereof that we got to deal with.
Yeah, and I think there's a big piece that we miss a lot of times because we're so symptom driven. We don't get that we got to plant seeds today for that will help kids turn out later. Like, I had I grew up in a neighborhood not very much different than Sandtown, and I had a big brother when I was 9 years old. And at the time, he would not have known he was making a difference with me. I can tell you, because I wasn't telling him. And, like, if we start getting in there, like, right now, there's a fishbowl that most of the residents in Sandtown live in. They don't venture out of Sandtown very much, a lot of the people who live there, or not very far away from Sandtown. We got to start, like, bringing the larger world to them so they can see it, so they can see that there's something going on in the world outside of the way that they live. And if they can see that, then we can support them to have the lives that they want to have, not the ones we want them to have, but the lives that they want to have. So there's a planting that needs to be, or seeding that needs to take place to give people a different way of viewing the world.
And I want to encourage people, I'm going to go by the phones, go to me and then write to the phones to Crystal or the next caller up. But I want this Tuesday night at 7 p.m., at 6:30 p.m., excuse me, at Elder Harris's church in Sandtown, we'll be having a gathering. It's the Baltimore Food and Faith Project and the Mark Steiner Show. It's another good food gathering, and this time we're gathering in Sandtown to explore how Sandtown itself is trying to create their own jobs and create increased food access. It'll be Elder C.W. Harris, and we'll talk about his Strength and Love Farm and Newborn Holistic Ministries, all taking place at his church, 6:30 at located at 1947 Pennsylvania Avenue. So come join us there for this live town meeting. We'll be broadcasting later on the air, but we're talking about solutions coming out of the community and hearing what the community has to say. So we'll be there. We would love everybody to join us and be part of that on this coming Tuesday night. Mia?
I'm just kind of reflecting. I think one thing that keeps getting lost from the conversation is that there are people that have a vested interest in the issues of, you know, in Baltimore. Mm-hmm. And I would say working, you know, at a nonprofit and doing a solutions-oriented thing that actually worked, I played myself out of position a lot of times because, you know, the kids were starting to be able to just go to the side themselves and work it out. And, you know, I'm a firm believer that peer leaders are the most effective. So then they started teaching others, and my job is always to do as little as possible and to leave eventually. But if I'm getting money from certain problems existing, then I'm going to perpetuate those problems or make sure that there's not a full solution. So, you know, when we're talking about coming together and demanding more, we have to, like, you know, go all in. We can't look at distractions. Like, that we have a violence issue in Baltimore. What we've seen the past couple of weeks has been horrendous. But we have to understand that it's being thrown in our face a little bit more. It's not really that different than what we've been seeing for decades.
Right.
There's always been a third of violent crimes have been youth under 18. We have an average of between 300 and 400 murders a year. This has been going on for a long time. It's affecting everyone. There's a lot of trauma in the community. People are stuck in traumatic ages. People are going through depression, all that type of stuff. So we can't let the increased attention on community violence take away from our demands for justice and our demands for better communities and building. We have to stay on course.
There's a huge question here. Maybe we can wrestle with another day. I won't even go there now, but I will come back to it later. I don't want to push the discussion the wrong way. 410-319-8888. Crystal, you're on the air, line two.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't hear the entire broadcast. However, I did hear the part end of it. And I know that we can definitely help one another. We have a man, I'm not sure who has and hasn't heard of him. His name is Jesse Turner. What he's doing, he did back in 2010, and he's doing again this year. Actually, he starts tomorrow. He's one man walking in the name of love. He's walking 400 miles in 40 days. From Connecticut to D.C., he's stopping in New York, New Jersey, Delaware, Pennsylvania, Maryland, D.C. Now, we have a lot of events that he's stopping at and basically offering the opportunity. What he's originally walking for is our kids, for everything, for the high-stakes testing, for the, you know, inequalities in education, in, you know, for everything that you guys are for and more. And he's giving all of these areas, including Baltimore, which he's going to be here July 22nd on 2015.
Mm-hmm.
Well, obviously it's this year, sorry, at 10 a.m. at the Dream House. So I know I needed to call to make this connection. I don't think that it's been made yet. We still have some openings available for,
okay,
you know.
Since that's over a month away and people are probably not going to hold that in, why don't you send that to us here? It's at mark@steinershow.org. Send it to me.
Mark.
Mark with a C at steinershow.org.
Okay, I'm going to have to stay on the line after we're done to get that spelled down correctly.
Okay, fine. Okay, and I'll get that to you.
Yes, I just wanted to, you know, offer that also to any callers that's listening, because I know that a lot of people, especially, you know, in Baltimore right now are, you know, they're ready and willing to help. They just don't know what to do or where to begin or how to get their voice out. and we have a lot of media contacts, and we have a lot of different things, and okay. You know, this is an opportunity for everybody.
So it's Mark, M-A-R-C, at steiner.org. But you can stay online, and when somebody can pick up and give you the information and send it to us, and we'll talk about that as that approaches closer.
I mean, I'm for all kind of crowdsourcing and individual and collective opportunities, but I think, like I said, there's some things that we're missing. The violence is connected, the physical violence is connected to economic violence and the decades of that, right? And that is something that, you know, at the end of the day, we just value certain folks differently. And until we find a way and a will to shift that part of the conversation, we're not going to find the political will. There are certain conversations you can't have in Maryland, right? So the Opportunity Collaborative just came out with workforce, transportation, housing. You know what wasn't on that agenda? Education, because it's not politically viable to have that conversation. And look, I was a part of that to some small extent. I did what I could do. And I think the next step is the implementation. So, you know, we got a lot of work to do, but we're not ready yet quite in Maryland. We think we're a lot more progressive than we are as a state, but I mean, I've seen in other places where they're having different conversations with a different level of urgency and tenor and pitch. And when we try to have some of those same conversations, you know, stuff starts to get shut down, and you kind of find out where you really are in Maryland.
That's why, maybe because we have to take it outside the normal political process if we want to get anything
absolutely.
That's where protests come from, or that's what sparks the protests, and that's what sparks people strange. Jumping up and saying things. Because I understand what you're saying when you say that we can't have those conversations, because in that political realm, that's true. But when the people stand up, they say, we're going to have the conversation anyway.
That's
like,
right.
We would not be having this conversation about Sandtown had it not been for people throwing bottles and burning CVS down. So it really comes down to that when we decide we're going to have the conversations, we can have those conversations. The question is, how are we going to get to having those conversations? How are we going to get there? Do we want to go through what we've already gone through and continue having people get to the last straw before we have the conversations? Or are we going to have the conversations because the people are ready to have the conversations?
And you know, we just did something with policy with presenting that to the police principals the other day. To your point, it's the action too. Yeah.
Besides, I'm afraid I think sometimes we present that to them, but me sometimes I think we have to get some kind of political power to tell them what to do,
absolutely,
not to ask them what we think they should
yeah,
do.
Yeah, like Delegate Carter, she spoke to police getting all the resources. Like the FOP is a strong gang. They go hard. Like if you say we're going to cut $1,000 so you can't get the brand new Mustang or something, they will, you know, put a lot of political pressure on. And there's very, you know, few entities on the community behalf that go just as hard or make sure that they're on top of every policy that's going through that you know, will affect. And there's a million reasons for that. And I'm also wanting to say, one thing that I always say is that you know, we don't have payphones anymore with the introduction of the cell phone. Nobody
right.
had to protest payphones. Nobody had to say, oh, we don't want payphones anymore. It just, the alternative was created. So that's certainly something that has to be a focus. Like, do you have to have it on both sides? You have to have people saying, we don't like that, and being very firm, but you also have to have a steady, step-by-step, we're doing this instead. And then you always see government follow. A really small example, but a good example, is school lunches, school breakfast. The Panthers started that program. The government wasn't doing it at the time. They saw that it worked on that side, so they, you know, took it over to try to regain community trust and control, you know, so.
And that is true. I mean, that is where it began. And I think we only got about 2 minutes left. Let me get a very quick caller in here before we close out. Ricky, you've got, like, give me a minute. Go ahead, Ricky.
Okay, I'll make it real fast.
After, yeah, we're almost out of time.
Hello, okay. Look, we need a building, so you got to have the churches. Okay, like you said, the Panthers had buildings. We need buildings. Right now we have kids raising kids. We got to plant a seed. That mother that came to rescue her teenager, she can't be at work and raise him at the same time. So the parents that aren't working can be at that church with the reverend, and they can be those children's parents. Right now, we got kids raising kids in that capacity in these schools from that time when they get out of school to the parents get home. And that's all I'm saying. Now, if the churches can do sick and shut in, they can get out here. And like you say, we need to plant seeds. This thing that we have now will be over in a minute, but We want something that lasts for a long time. I'm done.
Amen. Thank you, Ricky. And we do. And we're going to continue this weekly conversation about what we can do to keep pushing people who are building and trying to change things in our community. And I'll just leave one kind of thought here is that, you know, if we did little simple things for our political leaders did, if we put money into something like Safe Streets and other programs that worked in the community every day to help people out with their problems and stop the violence, then the police could focus on what they need to focus on, which is capturing the people who committed the murders in the first place and building trust with the community by letting that take place and stop arresting all of our people, young people, and putting them in jail. I mean, I think there are ways we can begin to do this, but we have to think about it. We have to push our leaders to do it. We have to propose it. And I want to thank our guests. This has been great. Delegate Carter joining us earlier. J.C. Falk, first time in the studio, community organizer and community development consultant. We'll be walking the streets in Sandtown with him and others in the coming week. Mia Loving, always great to have her in the studio with her profound thinking curator and founder of Invisible Majority, a creative community incubator. Always good to have you here, Mia. And your baby, and your baby's outside, right?
Yeah.
Always, always, always. And Michael Scott, Chief Equity Officer and President and co-founder of Equity Matters. And inviting you all to join us 6:30 Tuesday night in Sandtown at Elder Harris's Church on Pennsylvania Avenue for our town meeting on the future and what Sandtown's doing to rejuvenate itself. So please stay with us and join us for that as well. And as we go to break here, what are we listening to? Smashing? Is it Smashing? Uh-huh. Okay, we'll do that. Smashing Pumpkins, 1979. Jimmy Chamberlain of Smashing Pumpkins, born on this day in 1964. We'll be right back with Chauncey Whitehead, a monthly look at fitness. Don't go away.